So today we're looking at chapter 8. First canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 8, the prayers by Queen Kunti. And we're also we're beginning with the last phase of dealing with Ashwatthama. Previously we discussed how Ashwatthama killed the five sleeping sons of Draupadi, and took their heads to Duryodhana, who was lying on the ground, almost ready to die, having been defeated by Bhima at the end of the Battle of Kurukshetra. And of course, when Ashwatthama delivered the heads, Duryodhana crushed those skulls and was able to detect that those heads were not those of the Pandavas but of the children. And so he was, rather than being pleased, he was quite disgusted with the activities of Ashwatthama for performing an activity which would destroy not only the line of kings of from the Pandavas, but also the descendants coming from Duryodhana as well. They're all in one sense considered part of the great Kuru dynasty, which had reigned the earth for I think over 1,000 years, something like that. So of course it was to have your dynasty reigning over the earth for 1,000 years, and then Ashwatthama literally wiping out any hope for that dynasty to continue was very disappointing to Duryodhana. And of course in itself it was a heinous and very sinful activity. So Duryodhana was punished by Arjuna in such a way that he was killed by being deprived of all his assets, literally except for his body. And even his body, he had the hair and moustache and what have you snipped here and there, so that he was totally humiliated. In this way, everyone was satisfied that he'd been punished in such a way that it was comparable to death. And yet for soft-hearted devotees such as Draupadi, who didn't want to inadvertently punish the Brahminical community and Ashwatthama's mother Kripi as well, so his life was spared, and in this way everyone was satisfied with the punishment, and then he was released. So now at this stage, the Pandavas desiring to deliver water to the dead relatives who had desired it went to the Ganges with Draupadi's and the ladies. They walked in front and they offered Ganges water to each of the departed souls, and sufficiently lamented over the tragic loss of so many lives. Then Lord Sri Krishna, of course, pacified everyone. And we see that the Pandavas were there Dhritarashtra was still there, Gandhari, Kunti, Draupadi. There were very few left after the Battle of Kurukshetra, and they performed the rites. For the departed souls. And Lord Sri Krishna, of course, cited the, spoke on different, the nature of the laws of material nature and the nature of the soul being bound within the body, the eternal nature of the soul. All of these various philosophical aspects, of course, are discussed generally at the time of death. There are certain things that we can speak, you know, when there is people are grieving for someone who's passed away, which does offer them some, you know, the consoling words, because. Generally at the time of death people have the mood that that person is gone forever, and when they hear, you know, that each living entity is an eternal spirit soul different from the body and that life goes on, it helps them to understand that it is not a final end, that spirit soul is existing somewhere. That is very comforting. Quite often, of course, also, you know, people become very confused. You know, how has this happened? How did such a person die in this way and what have you? And therefore, to cite the laws of the material nature, how they act, carrying our, you know, karma from many, many lifetimes, not just one lifetime. Again, helps to console, because they can understand that although they may not have seen, you know, why someone died, you know, at such a time in such a way, they can understand that somewhere, perhaps in a previous life, it has brought it to this particular point. So in this way, Krishna cited these various different philosophical points in order to console the those who are remaining. we discussed at length last week how Duryodhan and his party had usurped the kingdom of Yudhisthira, and by the grace of Lord Sri Krishna, that kingdom had been recovered, and all of those unscrupulous kings who joined with Duryodhan, they were killed, and many others died as well. And especially it's cited here that the duration of life having been decreased for their rough handling of the hair of Queen Draupadi. And we discussed the five different persons which Vedic culture seeks to protect: the brahmanas, the cows, women, children and old men. So we looked at that in detail, how it leads to, it gives everyone, it gives society and all the individuals within society the opportunity to achieve success in life, both materially and spiritually, when those five are protected. And therefore because the progressive society depends upon their protection, and because they're somewhat innocent persons who need protection, you know, insulting them or killing them is, you know, considered quite sinful. and in the case of Draupadi, it was, you know, there was an escalation in the offence and the sinful nature Draupadi, of course, was the wife of the five Pandavas. Her hair had been sanctified in the Rajasuya Jagya. So to roughly handle her hair, Draupadi, of course, was she was off the altar at that time, and therefore she was wearing one simple cloth, and so she was not sufficiently dressed as it was, and she was dragged by the hair, of course, and dragged into the assembly, and they tried to strip her naked, and of course Duryodhan showed his thighs to Draupadi, and there were many she was very roughly handled, which was a great insult to any woman, of course, but of course she was the wife, she was known as it was also understood that she was born, from the Jagya performed by Draupada. So, she was actually born from a sacred ceremony, which makes it all the more, worse, sinful. There were, and of course she was known to be a great devotee of the Lord, very devoted to the Supreme Lord. So for many, many different reasons, the quality of the sinfulness particularly escalated in the case of Draupadi. she herself cursed all of those who were responsible. She said herself that those who had loosened her hair on that day, they would see all of their wives' hair loosened, due to the fact that all their relatives would be killed. And
is that the reason why she washes her hair in the blood of?
Sorry? There were curses made, that because of what had happened, they would, do certain things, and that sounds like part of it as well. So, they're actually at the point here where, Draupadi's words have come to pass, that all of the wives have had to loosen their hair because all their sons, husbands, fathers, have all been killed, and so for this ceremony their hair becomes loosened. Krishna also spoke the same as Draupadi. He also said that that would happen, and of course the Pandavas also declared that the words that Draupadi had spoken would come to pass. So in this way they've reaped the reaction to their sinful activities and their offences. We see here in verse 6, of course, that Lord Krishna caused three well-performed astramated jagyas to be conducted by Maharaj Yudhisthira, which caused his fame, Maharaj Yudhisthira's fame, to be glorified in all directions. So that didn't happen straight here. There was certain events that took place, and after a suitable time had passed, certain other things had to be done, of course, in order for Maharaj Yudhisthira to perform those ceremonies. there's just a very brief summary there. It's included here in summary form because it's a very important event, but it happened just a little later. So it brings us up to verse 7, where again we see Ashwatthama coming back into the picture. Lord Krishna is preparing for his departure. So the Pandavas the Brahmanas, head of Ashula Vyasadeva, are offering worship to Krishna. The Lord's reciprocating. Here it says in the purport, apparently Lord Sri Krishna was a Kshatriya. The Lord purposely observed all these social customs so that others would follow him in the future. So as he seated himself on the chariot ready to start for Dwarka, he sees Uttara hurrying toward him in fear. Now Uttara of course is the mother of Parikshit Maharaj. Parikshit Maharaj is the son of Uttara and Abhimanyu. Abhimanyu, of course, is the son of Arjun. So he's the son of Arjun, and others would be like his uncles, the other Pandavas. And he is the last in line in the Kuru dynasty. And Ashwatthama has Uttara is hurried toward Krishna in fear, and she's asked for the Lord to protect her she says here, of course, there's no one else who can save me from the clutches of death in this world of duality. We see that in the purport describes that all the family of the Pandavas were completely dependent upon the protection of Krishna. They all had that mood. In verse 10 we see it states that a fiery arrow is coming towards me fast. Let it burn me personally if you so desire, but please do not let it burn and abort my embryo. So,
If Abhimanyu was 16 years old, how old was he?
Uttara?
Yes.
I'm not sure. I haven't seen her age mentioned. Usually younger, but she could have had a child anywhere from the age of 13. Prabhupada's first child was born when his wife was about 13 or 14. Years old. It's not uncommon. It's uncommon now. Mm-hmm. Actually, there's a strange phenomenon happening now, is that young girls 7 years old are increasing, reaching puberty, you know, for some reason. But that's unusual. But she could have been anywhere from 13 to 16. You see here this in verse number 9, pahi pahi, protect protect, mahayogin, the greatest mystic, mahayogin, deva deva, the worshipful of the worshipped Lord of the universe, deva deva jagatpate, nanyam tvad abayam pasye, which the translation is, anyone else than you, fearlessness I do not see. So abayam, so literally apart from Krishna, no one else can produce a sense of fearlessness, or you know, you seek their protection and you actually feel protected. And it's paraphrased in the translation that there, I see no one else can save me from the clutches of death. So certainly there's a sense of fear that death is there, but she's more concerned really with her embryo. That's but she's addressing, you know, Krishna. You are someone who can so much protect one from fear that you can even protect them from death. Not that I'm asking you necessarily to protect me from death. If you so desire, I'll die, but certainly, you know, protect my embryo from death. And you know, as mentioned in verse 10, that you know, why did Uttara not follow the path of her husband? Because she was pregnant, and Maharaj Prickett, of course, was a great devotee of the Lord, so he was an embryo within the room, so she was responsible for his protection. So the same mood is there in approaching Lord Krishna. So generally in those days, of course, when the husband died, the wife would enter within the fire along with the you know, body of the husband, the sati rite, but she didn't do so because she was pregnant, so she had a duty to perform to protect her child. And in that mood, and because this is a very special child, she's approached Lord Sri Krishna. So yeah, no.
How could she? She could see the weapon coming towards her.
Yes.
She could see it.
Yes. Yeah, it describes that in verse 11, having patiently heard her words, Lord Sri Krishna, who is always very affectionate to his devotees, could at once understand that Ashvatthama, the son of Dronacharya, had thrown the Brahmastra to finish the last life of the Pandava family. So he'd actually thrown one Brahmastra to kill the embryo, and one Brahmastra for each of the Pandava brothers. And the only those to who the Brahmastra is coming to can actually see it coming. They could see it coming towards them. Those weapons can be released in different ways. They can be released by an arrow. They can be released by the mind. They can be released by the breath. So depending on how it is released, they, you know, but because of the you know, the mystical nature of those weapons, yeah, no one else can see them. But they are released in different ways as well, which may affect it. In other words, you may see someone fire an arrow, but you may not necessarily see them release a Brahmastra if they do it mentally. But it has the same effect. But these weapons have a you know, they have a personified form. So you know, the person who has those weapons, they will see that weapon, you know standing, attending them, waiting to offer service, you know, in a personified form. So that, you know, they're quite subtle, quite unusual weapons, you know. I'm not sure exactly, you know, in what form one sees them coming towards you, but they do have a personified form. Certainly the person who properly knows how to use them sees that personified form, you know, standing there waiting to offer that service. They're very, very subtle. That's why we see in the verse 12, of course, it says, seeing the glaring Brahmastra proceeding towards them, the Pandavas took up their five respective weapons. And arrows were, you know, because the Brahmastra was coming towards them as well.
Just one question. Previously, when Brahmastra was released by Ashwadhama,
yes,
Krishna said that only Brahmastra can stop, another Brahmastra can stop it, isn't it?
Yes.
Then when this was released, Pandavas,
why did they pick up their
weapons?
What was
the intention?
I mean,
when only another Brahmastra can stop it.
Yes. That is described here. So your question is, why did they take up arrows?
Yes.
Yes, because they you can release an arrow to release a Brahmastra.
But as far as I know, only Arjuna has the knowledge of Brahmastra, isn't it? Not other
not sure that only Arjuna had them, because, you know, there are occasions where demigods gave particular weapons to Arjuna, and he was able to teach the mantras to his brothers. It is to release a Brahmastra weapon, you need to know the mantra. The mantra has to have been, you know, it's a secret mantra, and the process. Those mantras were taught to Arjuna, and there's no reason he couldn't teach those mantras to his brothers. And on certain occasions, I know that I've read that he was given certain weapons like that, and he taught the mantras to his brothers. I know when Arjuna first came back from the heavenly planets, where he'd received a lot of these weapons, and his brothers greeted him, the way up in the Himalayas on the Gandhamandana Mountain, somewhere up there, some very elevated place. And he told him about all the weapons he received, and Yudhisthira said, "Show me." So Arjuna was about to show him the Brahmastra and the mantras and everything, and the weapons. All of a sudden, Brahma and many of the demigods and sages appeared and said, "You cannot show them until such a time as they're actually going to be used." So he said that they will see the nature of these weapons when they're used in the Battle of Kurukshetra. So that they can be taught by Arjuna to his brothers. he was going to show them one time, but he was told you got to show them when they're actually going to be used, in one sense. In Vishwanath Chakravarti, the Kaur's comments to verse 13, he says that now Ashwatthama had released 5 separate Brahmastras for each of the Pandavas, one for each. And this was difficult to counteract because it would take time to release 5 Brahmastras. So, in his commentary, he's saying that they were actually going to release,
That means only one person was releasing 5 Brahmastras, isn't it? If 5 of them are simultaneously. Because previously Arjuna did the same thing. When Brahmastra was coming, there was time for him to release another Brahmastra.
Yes.
But if he has to release 5 Brahmastras, it may not have so much of time. But
Yes. So that's possible that Arjuna was releasing 5 Brahmastras to counteract 5. Yes, Arjuna had counteracted 1 Brahmastra with 1 of his previously. So now Ashwatthama had released 5 separate Brahmastras for each of the Pandavas. This was difficult to counteract because it would take time to release 5 Brahmastras. So it can be taken in that way, yes, that Arjuna would have had to release 5. In verse 12, it's saying that seeing the glaring Brahmastra proceeding towards them, the Pandavas took up their 5 respective weapons.
They were bound to take their weapons.
That's
the reason why they pick up their weapons.
Yes, it's not completely clear. In the purport of verse 13, it describes when the Lord saw that there was no time for the Pandavas to counteract the Brahmastra of Ashwatthama, he took up his weapon, even the risk of breaking his own vow. There it's using the word in the sense of the Pandavas as if they're each trying to counteract a Brahmastra. You see that in verse 13. So there was no time for the Pandavas. I mean, if he had said no time for Arjuna to counteract 5 Brahmastras, that sounds more like one person trying to But I'm not completely clear on that one. But so there's two ways we can look at that. You know, one is that either Arjun is himself, trying to counteract five weapons. In which case, we're wondering why the Pandavas at all took up their weapons, knowing that it could not be counteracted. They'd know these things. But the way it's being stated is that it almost appears that they were going to try and counteract Brahmastras with Brahmastras. Something that probably needs a little bit more investigation there. But either way, whether it's Arjun trying to counteract five, or each of the Pandavas invoking, you know, five separate Brahmastras, either way it was considered at this particular stage too difficult a task. So therefore, Krishna took up his Sudarshan disc to protect them, and what's significant about Krishna taking up his Sudarshan chakra? What's significant about that? Bhakta Vatsala, yeah, which is the lover of his devotee. How does that? In what way? Why does that demonstrate? And in one sense, the war is not completely over because it's still under attack. But breaking his vow was not as important. That aspect of maintaining morality, he'd rather be known as, rather than the moralist, he'd rather be known as a protector and lover of his devotees. So therefore, we see that in verse 14, Sri Krishna, who resides within everyone's heart as a Paramatma, and just to protect the progeny of the Kuru dynasty, he covered the embryo of Uttara by his personal energy. And it's described in the purport. Interesting, of course, in the purport it describes that the in the translation, he covered the embryo of Uttara by his personal energy. So later in the third canto, in the third chapter, text number 17, there's just a little description of this as well, and it describes there that actually the body of Pariksit Maharaj was burnt. It did destroy the actual body that that spirit soul was residing in, and he was given a second body.
I don't understand how it works mechanically again, because he was burned with the mother's life and running.
It was particularly for the embryo. Well, you can see here, of course, you know, where it describes that the Pandavas took up their weapons, and we've discussed that either Arjun was going to counteract all five, or each of them was going to. Seeing that there was no time, Krishna took out his Sudarsana Chakra, and we can see just how little time there was, because actually the body was burnt of you know, Parikshit Maharaj, the embryo. Yes, but you know, that is how subtle and how accurate these Brahmastras are. They can be directed at, you know, one particular person. And the Lord actually gave him a second body. Describes here that in the purport to that third canto, this incident is direct proof that the body and the living entity are different. The particular living entity who was selected to be the descendant of Maharaj Puru, or the Pandavas, was not an ordinary living entity, and by the superior will of the Lord he was destined to be the successor of Maharaj Yudhisthira. Therefore, when Ashwatthama destroyed the embryo of Maharaj Parikshit, the Lord, by his own internal potency, entered into the womb of Uttara by his plenary portion, just to give audience to Maharaj Parikshit, the would-be Maharaj Parikshit. And Prabhupada says here, the would-be Maharaj Parikshit. By his appearance within the womb, the Lord encouraged the child and gave him complete protection in a new body by his omnipotency. So, and we see in verse 15, Lashanaka, although the supreme Brahmastra weapon released by Ashwatthama was irresistible and without check or counteraction, it was neutralized and fall when confronted by the strength of Vishnu. So in other words, you know, none of the Pandavas actually counteracted it. So it was not counteracted. It was not checked by usually you'll see, oh yes, some Kshatriya has counteracted, but it was not counteracted. Here in the purport it's describing that you know, it was confronted by the strength of Vishnu, Teja. The particular word there is Teja, this the Lord's strength, potency, you know, his energy. In other words, the glowing effulgence known as Brahma Tejas, you know, Krishna's spiritual energy, is nothing but the rays of the Lord. So this Brahma weapon, although materially irresistible, could not surpass the supreme strength of the Lord. So it was neutralized by the Lord's own energy. So generally, you know, one will counteract a Brahmastra with another Brahmastra, it will neutralize that energy. Here, Krishna's own spiritual effulgence was sufficient, you know, had more potency than millions of Brahmastras in order to neutralize that. In order to do that, Krishna appeared within the womb of Uttara. Mm. We know that the Paramatma is already situated within the womb. So here we've got the words verse 14. Yogeshwara, the Lord of all mysticism. So because the Lord, by his mystic power, Krishna, who was standing outside, with Uttara and what have you, he also entered within. That's his mystic potency, just as a yogi may expand themselves into different forms. So Krishna expanded himself, so he was standing, so they still saw him standing in front of them, and at the same time they saw him standing there and they were looking at him. They knew, Uttara also knew, he's entered within my womb. We know that the super soul is already present there, but Krishna actually entered Uttara's womb, but in the form of the super soul, he neutralized the Brahmastra. Therefore, we'll see later in chapter 12, in some of the verses there, that it describes here that he was observed by the Lord. In chapter 12, verses 7 to 11, Parikshit Maharaj observed the Lord. He was only thumb high, very beautiful, blackish. He wore a dress of lightning yellow, helmet of blazing gold. He was seen by the child. He had four hands, earrings of molten gold, eyes blood red. He loitered about, his club constantly encircling him like a shooting star. And Prabhupada describes in the purport, the Supreme Lord Govinda, by one of his plenary portions, enters into the halo of the universe and distributes himself as Paramatma, or the super soul, within the heart of every living being, within every atom. Thus he entered within the womb of Uttara to save his beloved devotee Maharaj Parikshit. So, even as Srila Prabhupada mentions in that purport in chapter 12, text 9, that Lord Govinda entered within the womb. So Krishna entered within the womb, he was visible, in his forearm Paramatma feature. But still actually Krishna, we would consider Uttara has asked Krishna, and Krishna has actually entered within the womb like that. But he was seen in his forearm Paramatma feature. The Lord was thus engaged in vanquishing the radiation of the Brahmastra, just as the sun evaporates a drop of dew. He was observed by the child, who thought about who he was. While thus being observed by the child, the Supreme Lord, Personality of Godhead, Super Soul of everyone, Conqueror and Protector of the righteous, who stretches in all directions and who is unlimited by time and space, disappeared at once. So, Paramatma feature was already there, within the womb, Krishna entered, and in his Paramatma feature, although Krishna was there, but in his Paramatma feature, he was visible to Parikshit Maharaj, in that little embryo. Before that, he wasn't visible. So although the super soul was there, Krishna entered and made himself visible to Parikshit Maharaj, and then having destroyed the influence of the Brahmastra, he then, although he was still there in his Paramatma feature, but then he was not visible. And so verse 16, of course, just Sri Goswami just describing that, you know, don't think this is something so wonderful, because you know, as his paramatma feature, of course, he's maintaining and annihilating, you know, the whole material world. It's not difficult, you know. We may think, you know, how is that possible? You know, that he enters into, you know, one the womb of Uttara and, you know, destroyed this Brahmastra. But we have to understand that he's actually entering into every single universe. And
what is wonderful is that I'm assuming that the super soul could have done the protection if he wanted, because he goes in there personally.
Yes.
Remember,
that's right.
You know, so that's not wonderful.
That's a fact. Yeah. You know, there was certainly a special gift to, you know, Parikshit Maharaj there, that he was able to see Krishna save him, and that he was able to, you know, as an embryo. And of course, he was able to go through life with that vision always there within his mind, because it didn't leave him. And of course, you know, he would have understood from Uttara that, you know, I asked Krishna to protect you, and he did. And he said, "Yeah, I saw him." So it would have been an interesting conversation as he grew up, him telling Uttara what he saw, and Uttara telling him, you know, what was going on the outside. Any questions?
Just a comment.
Yep.
That the degree of maturity of people in that age, I mean, of people that come, offer that limit compared to people.
Yeah. It's a fact. Yes. Yeah, it's a fact. Even you know, powerful rishis, and they act differently in Kali Yuga than, you know, if they've existed previously in different ages. The nature of Kali Yuga, even powerful rishis, sometimes to some degree their activities maybe a little different as well, because of the nature of the age. Not in a degraded way, but
is the effect of the mode?
What's that?
Is it the effect of the mode?
No, not the effect of the modes of material nature. Give you an example of Hanuman. You know, when Bhima saw Hanuman, and he asked Hanuman to reveal the huge form that he manifested when he entered into Lanka, and he said that you know, his body increases in proportion to the size of the enemy. So, you know, in Kali Yuga it just wouldn't grow that big, because, you know, one, you don't have enemies of the nature of Ravana and what have you. But so Kali Yuga, you know, has its effect, but not on you know, personalities such as like that. It's not a material effect, but still, you know, by the influence of time, it changes things. So, you know, therefore they're not necessarily different beings or a different caliber of person in one sense. What the, you know, the point I'm trying to make, that, you know, if for those who exist in that time, you know, we would be, you know, of that same caliber to one degree or another. The influence of the age allows you to do more or less, you know. So it's not as if we're really just two different types of beings in that sense. You know, we're very much constrained by the influence of Kali Yuga, but if we're actually existing in Dwapara Yuga at the time of Krishna, those constraints would be, you know, lifted to some degree, and we would be seeing each other in one sense as, you know, equals. Although even in, you know, Dwapara Yuga, or, you know, in their time, they were considered the best among the best, but still, amongst others in that time, we would be sort of like equals. Because of the restricting influence of the age would not be there.
Question from the previous chapter. This says that there is no injunction for killing the body of a Brahma Bandhu.
Yeah, so what happens there, of course, is that all the various injunctions are examined, and according to time, place and circumstance, some of them, you know, was one of the things that Markandeya Rishi spoke to Yudhisthira when they were in the forest. It was asked, you know, which particular religious injunctions are more important than the others, and he sort of listed different categories. And the answer was that according to time, place and circumstance, one takes more prominence over another. So if we say there's no injunction for killing a Brahmana Bandhu, so that's a particular injunction, you know, and then we take another injunction that he's an aggressor, so that's another. So then we have to look at the time, place and circumstance and see of all the various ones that are applicable, which becomes the most important. But and therefore in some circumstances, you know, one may be totally overridden and he may be killed. I think Indra killed Pritishura, and there was some offence there. It was Pritishura, was he a Brahmin? Brahmin, son of a Brahmin? There was some. Yeah, now there was some. There's a story somewhere where you know, there was an offence due to killing a Brahmana. I can't remember exactly which one it was, but according to time, place and circumstance, it was necessary. There was a reaction, but the demigod or whoever it was particularly had to just atone for it. We see that Lord Balaram killed Ramaha Shansuta. He was a Brahmana. So, what's that? Ramaharshan.
Wasn't he
No.
I think his father was Kshatriya and the mother was a Brahmin. I think
the mixed. Okay, for Brahmin Harshan, yeah. Okay, so the mother.
Yeah, that's why
his father was okay, inferior, so considered there's some Brahminical because the father was the Kshatriya, so he was considered Kshatriya?
I don't know what exactly I read at that time. It was saying that he is not a true Brahmana because father was not a Brahmana.
Yes,
his mother was a Brahmana.
Yeah.
He's not considered to be the true,
True Brahminical birth.
Yes.
But still he was acting as a Brahmana,
yes,
by reciting the, you know, Puranas. In that sense, there are different Shastric injunctions that if someone, you know, has that profession, the qualifications and what have you, then they can be accepted as good as a Brahmana. And because he caused the offence, he was accepted, in that position until he caused an offence, and then they looked at his background and said, we won't look at the background, but now that you've become offensive, we'll have a look and we'll see. There are some deficiencies. Yeah. So he was acting as a Brahmana, and there was, he was sort of borderline by birth, but. But still, they all decided, because of his status, teaching, acting like as a Brahmin, teaching the scriptures and what have you, that he shouldn't have been killed, and therefore they asked Balaram, of course, to atone for that. there are other examples, probably better ones, but the point being that you take. According to time, place and circumstance, one of the many different religious principles, which are all correct, but one of them becomes more important than the others. It's not that one of them is always more important, but in time, place and circumstance, one becomes more important. That's why it is that's why it's said that religious principles can really only be understood by approaching the Mahajans or the authorities, because it's just it's something where one has to be particularly really well versed, well studied. One has to have heard from very expert, persons. One has to know the scriptures, and then, there has to be some realization of that, so that according to time, place, and circumstance, many, for others, apparently conflicting issues, can be easily resolved by someone who knows religious principles. But if that's not there, a person hasn't studied from the people who are actually very expert and who know, and they haven't, studied the scriptures, their mind is not, purified, their intelligence is not pure and focused, then they cannot actually teach religious principles, because it is just too difficult, for someone who's unqualified. And that, hence we have to distinguish between Dvija Bandhu, Brahma Bandhu, and a Brahmana. There has to be that distinction, because it is too difficult a science for just someone who's associated in the Brahminical circles, to be able to teach. They really have to be qualified. It's so easy to get caught out. And therefore, as we go through Srimad Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita and Mahabharata and the Ramayana, we see how, the Supreme Lord Krishna and his very expert devotees, that their example shows us how to properly do that, how to properly see, you know, religious principles according to time, place and circumstance in so many different situations. That practically whatever situation will arise where religious principles have to be applied, and we somehow, you know, would think, well, gee, this appears to be a contradictory circumstance, you will find somewhere in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Mahabharata, you know, or Ramayana, you'll find somewhere in there where the Lord, in one of his expansions, or personally, or one of his devotees, has dealt with that exact situation, and it gives us that light of how to, you know, apply it. Otherwise, without that, it's not possible. It's not as if, you know, as some people do. See, some, you know, sometimes even young devotees, they'll whip through the Manu Samhita or something like that, and, you know, start questioning, you know, well, what are you doing? It says in the Manu Samhita that you should be stoned to death for what you've just done, or, you know, something. And also, you know, astrology. You know, I've had a lot of people ask me to teach them astrology, and I'm very, very reluctant in one sense, because usually I've said to, you know, people, I'll teach you, but you have to wait until I've taught you the whole thing over a couple of years before you start, you know, giving instructions. Yeah, and what I find is that within 2 weeks, you know, I hear that, oh, so-and-so's done my... And I think, what? You know, it's like there's just too much, you know, like I know how much they know and how much they don't, and how wrong... You know, how dangerous that can be, that you know, someone can give someone instructions at the most critical points of a person's life, where they're really depending, and, you know, they're going to take what you say as a, you know, friend or a preceptor, and they're going to do something, take a major, you know, step in life. So you know, it's very, what to speak of, you know, spiritual science. So this is, you know, we're very blessed to have the Bhagavad Gita and the, you know, Srimad Bhagavatam, and if we become, you know, conversant with them, you know, we can resolve all these things. For many people, of course, because they don't take the trouble to properly study, they don't even know that these pitfalls exist. You know, as you were saying, you know, it says here it says something else. A lot of people who read Srimad Bhagavatam without the association of devotees very quickly will just think, oh, there's just so many contradictions, you know. There's so many mistakes and contradictions, you know, I'm better off just, you know, nutting it out myself. Or, you know, they'll just pluck a few things out and just start applying them. I don't. Last week, of course, we had a really nice conversation about different quotes Srila Prabhupada related to women and children. you know, if they're not really properly analysed, you know, big mistakes can be made. I remember one time, just like, you know, austerity. So throughout, you know, these liturgies, we understand that we're supposed to learn austerity, and we're supposed to learn austerity from birth. And I remember one time I was travelling, doing padayatra around New Zealand with Indrajumna Swami and probably about you know, 100 to 200 devotees, depending where we were. we camped by a beach one time. There's a big oval we were all with our tents, and I was in the tent early in the morning chanting my rounds or something, and I heard this little boy, probably about 4 or 5 or something, maybe younger, 2 or 3 something, crying, you know, really loudly, and I was thinking, you know, there's so many people out there, surely someone's going to attend that boy, you know, I mean, I can hear it. Now, I think it was probably about 20, 30 yards away or something. And I knew there was people walking, I thought someone's going to, and it just went on and on. I thought that, you know, no one's going to do it. So I went, I went out to have a look, and then I saw the cause of the problem was that the father, because, you know, when you're camping, in the early hours of the morning, very, very cold, especially in New Zealand. So he was bathing his son, you know, with a cold bucket of water like this, and he's, you know, for a long, you know, long, you know, really scrubbing down. The kid's absolutely screaming and what have you. The father's walking past, handing around, thinking, you know, oh, it's good for these kids, you know, get a bit of austerity and what have you. So no one said anything, you know, and the father's just happily, you know, going away. So of course I went over and, you know, I said, you know, this is probably not correct, you know, he's too young, you know. I said, you know, most of the adults couldn't do what you're asking him to do. And but he tried, you know, he started preaching from the Srimad Bhagavatam, you know. Oh no, austerity, you know, Prabhupada says this, Prabhupada says this. And, this is a devotee who'd been around for about 10 years. So, you know, you see the importance if this sort of proper discussion and proper analysis of the scriptures doesn't go on, then without doubt, the generations of devotees that come after us, it will be just an absolute mess, an absolute nightmare of people with just plucking all sorts of things out of here, and there's some, you know, there's some pretty powerful statements in there that, you know, and if they're in the hands of the wrong people, Prabhupada said, you know, so I've got, you know, carte blanche authority to do this, and no one's stopping me because Prabhupada said, you know, it's there in the Bhagavatam. So we've seen this in these various pastimes here, how to many different religious principles will come up and they have to be applied according to time, place and circumstance, and one who's very expert will begin to understand that which principle becomes more important than the others in that circumstance. And then if one principle becomes more important than the others, are the others to be neglected, partially implemented, you know, neglected altogether, some, you know, adjustments made, that, you know, so like this, so there's still further considerations, not that, oh, this is more important, we'll forget the rest. That. And, you know, therefore, of course, we can understand Srila Prabhupada's insistence why, you know, devotees have to come to the mode of goodness in order to really become Krishna conscious and understand, you know, these Krishna conscious literatures, because so he wants us to, you know, follow the four regular principles, you know, illicit sex, no gambling, no intoxication, no meat eating. anyone who is, you know, strongly influenced by the lower modes of nature will be strongly motivated in their interpretation of scripture in order to facilitate their particular, you know, brand of sense gratification which they're attached to, you know. Coming to the mode of goodness means that a brahmana applies knowledge for the sake of duty, for the sake of attachment, without any motivation. And the symptom of someone who is, you know, detached and non-motivated, of course, is that, you know, that they can follow those regular principles. Otherwise, if they're severely compromised by sense gratification, you know, they cannot be trusted to, you know, present knowledge for the sake of knowledge and for the sake of duty. So, you know, one has to understand this knowledge, by coming to the mode of goodness, and then one can be trusted to utilize that knowledge by being situated in the mode of goodness. So, you know, when it says that it's not understandable by, you know, those influenced by the modes of nature, it's not an exclusive club, you know, that you're a sudra, you know, you can't, you know, it's people take it like that in India, of course, you know, these days, you know, not just in India, but actually other religions as well, they also take it that there's some exclusive club of people because of the dress they have and, you know, the rituals that they've gone through, whereby they can you know, study the scriptures and implement their activities, and others have no right. But it's not a matter of an exclusiveness, but a matter of qualification. And everyone, you know, women, Vaishyas, Sudras, Milechas, Yavanas, everyone is eligible to study and become a guru, and, you know, in the science of Srimad Bhagavatam, if they agree to accept the training and gradually come to the mode of goodness. So that, you know, no one is excluded, but they have to take the training. So it's not an exclusive club, but it's a matter of giving, everyone can have the opportunity to become qualified. If they don't take that opportunity, they are really not qualified to then be, you know. And therefore we also have to you know, be mindful of you know, who sits on the Vyasasan and, you know, speaks to the general devotees. You know, we have to be mindful of who's doing our bhakti brikshas and you know, namhattas, because we see that these things are expanding quite a lot at the moment. And you know, one of the things we're going to have to be careful of is, you know, that who is monitoring, who is, you know, leading these different groups, strongly influencing people from these scriptures. Have they properly studied them? Are they properly qualified? So these are the things that need to be implemented at some stage. Any comments or questions? Alright, let's look at the prayers of Queen Kunti. It's always good to, you know, keep in mind, you know, the importance of what we're doing. It's not just like a little book club, but literally the future quality of the movement, you know, rests upon these sort of groups, you know, very seriously understanding, you know, Srimad Bhagavatam, and then, you know, disseminating that within the community through all sorts of different projects.
Yes. Which I judge from people availing themselves of the step, for example.
Yeah.
And
oh, that's a very important. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Because if
it was just
then it's
better not. Yes. Yeah. There's no pride. Humility is the first symptom of knowledge. When we see humility has developed, we say, okay, the first symptoms that knowledge is actually being assimilated is manifesting. And if humility is not there, we can understand that even the preliminary symptoms of knowledge is not manifesting, what to speak of events and all. speaking of that, we come to these, you know, leads in beautifully to these prayers of Queen Kunti, of course, because we see Queen Kunti in her prayers. Let's look at verse number 18 and 19. Now, well, we see in verse 20, let's jump ahead a little bit. You yourself descend to propagate the transcendental science of devotional service unto the hearts of the advanced transcendentalists and mental speculators. So there, of course, confirmation that, you know, this spiritual science is meant for those who are, you know, spiritually advanced. And then she said, who are purified, as we said, coming to the mode of goodness, and able to discriminate between matter and spirit. How then can we women know you perfectly? And then with that beautiful you know, statement of humility, here she is, of course, with a wonderful understanding of Lord Sri Krishna, someone who's able to herself teach the transcendentalists and you know, and the mental speculators, but in her humility, which is the mood of a devotee, you know, she's saying that you know, I'm just you know, a woman. Generally, you know, women may not necessarily take to great austerities in the forests or the caves or what have you. You know, as a general principle, women may be more interested in you know, raising the family and the social interactions and you know, what is happening within society and how it relates to themselves and their family. As a very general statement, they're not, maybe not as inclined to wander off to the caves or the mountains or the you know, isolated places in the forest or the you know, Himalayas, in very extreme conditions, very, very difficult conditions, very harsh, very, very tough conditions on the body, and in those places try to completely, you know, philosophically and through meditation, just detach themselves from matter. So, you know, there's a general nature there. You know, as we say, not that, and there are highs and lows within that. But because that tendency is there, you know, we see in Vedic society that you know, the women would you know, rather than you know, predominantly accepting those very difficult circumstances on that path of seeking transcendence and transcendental knowledge, they would generally remain in their position, you know, within their family, within society, and seek that transcendental knowledge from the sages who would come travelling past, and they would offer them some, you know, assistance, and they would hear the various Puranas and what have you, like that. So, in one sense, you know, we see that whether man or woman, but when a person you know, is less inclined to accept you know, difficulties for the sake of you know, transcendental realization, it produces some obstacles to their advancement, you know. You know, so she's sort of accepting that mood that generally, because for women, they may be less inclined to accept those harsh difficulties required, it can, you know, as a general rule, create, you know, less opportunity for spiritual advancement. Now, for most rungs the yoga ladder, such as jnana yoga and astanga yoga, that may be true, but the difference here is that on the path of bhakti, it no longer ceases to be true. See? So, but she's not counting herself here as a transcendental great devotee of the Lord. She's counting herself generally that, you know, amongst the yogis and the jnanis, you know, we women are not so inclined as, you know, they are. So she's not thinking of herself in terms of being a transcendental devotee of the Lord, but, you know, a woman compared to yogis and jnanis in that sense. But when it comes to, you know, the bhakti, the devotional service of the Lord, this consideration, of course, becomes null and void. You know, then there's no disqualification or no impediment at all for spiritual advancement, whether one is a woman, a grihastha, a sannyasi, or what have you. But she's not going to say that, oh, it doesn't apply to me because I'm such a great devotee. It doesn't matter, you know. So she's not going to state it like that because she's not even considering, you know, that she's such a great devotee. But she certainly will state that she is completely dependent upon Krishna. Yes. Yes. That's right. What's that? Which? Text 20. Yes. There's some interesting statements there. Yeah. Yeah. Women in general are unable to speculate like philosophers, but they are blessed by the Lord because they believe at once in the superiority and almightiness of the Lord, and thus they offer obeisances without restriction. The Lord is so kind that he does not show special favour only to one who is a great philosopher. So here we see that in bhakti, you know, there's no impediment. He knows the sincerity of purpose, so he doesn't care, you know, at all about other material considerations. For this reason, only women generally assemble in great number in any sort of religious function. In every country, in every sect of religion, it appears that women are more interested than men. This simplicity of acceptance of the Lord's authority is more effective than showy, insincere religious fervour. Now, there's an interesting quote here showing the flip side of that. Srila Prabhupada's quote, which will be in your Prabhupada's quote book, to this same verse, text 20, he says, so women, they are not very much interested. It's generally, maybe a special woman, but they are otherwise, they sometimes become a devotee. Therefore, Krishna says, Tepi Yanti Param Gatim, as soon as they become devotees, they are also promoted. But generally, they're not interested. He says, not that even though they become interested, they keep behind. No, with the equal force of men, so they're also promoted. So, following her footsteps, any woman can also understand Krishna. So, it sort of stems in with what I was saying, that generally women are not so interested in the harsh austerities and, you know, philosophical speculation of, you know, that side of things. But as he says here, so, you know, maybe a special woman is, that's what he's saying, in that side of things. But he's saying, but as soon as they become devotees, they're also promoted. And he's saying, not that they become, not that even though they become interested, they keep behind. So he's saying that, okay, women become devotees, not that, you know, you should still consider that, you know, they're devotees but of a slightly lower grade. He's saying, no, don't think like that. He's saying that on the equal force with men, they're also promoted. A very nice quote. You know, so, you know, perhaps the austerities, the philosophical speculation may not be so attractive to them in general. Some special, a few, you know, rare among them. But generally it's not the case, and therefore we see in Bhagavad Gita that it's sort of stated that, but it doesn't matter because but it's the same with the vices. The vices and the sutras, they're classified in the same group, in that none of that in that group are specially interested in those, you know, austerities and difficulties and philosophy of, you know, advancing on the spiritual path. They're not just women vices, sutras like that. Or, but if they do become a devotee, then they advance with equal force for their activities as someone who may have been a brahmana or a kshatriya or male or what have you. So then there becomes no distinction that, you know, that someone is a sudra, someone is a vaishya, that they become a devotee, but oh, this devotee come from a brahmana family, so he's a better quality devotee, you know, and the others always remain inferior. It cannot be like that, not, you know, on any of those material qualifications. As soon as one becomes a devotee, they advance with equal force. The other point there is that, but, you know, the devotee's humility is that, oh, you know, yes, I'm a devotee, but I come from a very, you know, bad background, or like this, you're such a nice devotee, and you were born in a Brahmana family, obviously, you know, so advanced. So, you know, devotees will, you know, out of their humility, they may look at themselves as being very low according to their situation. And, you know, that's what Queen Kunti is doing. But actually, that's their humility. It's not necessarily a fact.
Also, along the lines, you know, Srila Prabhupada also introduced Brahmin initiation to ladies, to women, but these are not probably found in other sampradayas.
Yes.
He has considered the point.
Yes. But they don't. They don't accept the Brahminical thread. Again, it's the same point. It's not that if we have two Brahmins, one male and one female, that the female Brahmana without the thread is therefore considered lesser. But you know, there's when a woman marries a brahmana, she becomes a brahmani. You know, like in Vedic culture, you know, the woman marries a kshatriya, she becomes a kshatriya wife. Like this, the Prabhupada mentions that even though that's there, they're still considered in the class of women. And therefore, you know, for although they're twice born, they're still not given the thread because they are considered in, you know, the class of women. So, and that distinction is made to show that, for instance, if a woman is a brahmani, and she is married to a brahmana, she still becomes, she still should be, you know, dependent upon her husband. It's not that a woman thinks, well, now I'm a brahmana or a brahmani, therefore I act independently from my husband, my father, or, you know, like that. See? If a, you know, so again, we see in ISKCON that sometimes a woman may be a brahmani and marry a husband who's not a brahmana. Now, does that mean she acts independently of her husband? Yeah. So in order to just, you know, clarify that distinction, that the general, you know, for the running of society, even amongst devotees, who are, you know, can become completely transcendental to the, you know, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishnava, Sudra, what have you. But still, there is, you know, the general nature of a woman never leaves him, even as a devotee. And the general nature of a man never leaves them, even as a devotee, although they certainly, you know, transcend the modes of material nature. But it doesn't mean that, you know, a woman becomes a devotee, starts chanting 16 rounds and thinks, I'm completely transcendental now, you know, I'll become a wrestler, or, you know, you know, I'll go to war and, you know, become a soldier. You know, the general nature of women, they will act within that, according to the, you know, the body that they have, a man, just like men. We see that, you know, when men come to the movement, some of them, you know, even will become, you know, initiated as brahmanas, but their general work may, you know, because of the body that they're in, they may still generally work in the way that a sudra works. It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, someone comes, they take initiation, they get twice born. It doesn't necessarily mean they're all of a sudden, you know, qualified to, you know, perhaps, you know, give the regular Srimad Bhagavatam classes. You know, sometimes that's not possible, even though they're brahminically initiated and what have you. They're still, according to the you know, psychophysical makeup that they have, they still, you know, men will still act in certain ways. You know, and the same with women. It applies across the board. It's not, you know, it's not that all of a sudden their body changes. The body changes. It does change. In other words, you know, if one is, everyone comes from a sudra background, they take initiation, they take Brahman initiation. So you know, their body has changed. In fact, we see their body as a Brahman. They have a Brahmana body. But you know, it may still be more practical for them to act and to work in the type of works that, you know, sudras work at. Hard physical work without a lot of intellectual thinking. Some devotees are like that, even though they're brahminically initiated. Because of the... you know, even though they're very Krishna conscious and always thinking of Krishna and following regular principles and on a transcendental platform, you know, according to their body, some of them cannot sit, you know, for 5 or 10 minutes and read. They need to be out, you know, exerting massive amounts of energy and eating copious amounts of, you know, food and, you know, doing things like that. So, you know, it applies to men and women. It's not just that we're discriminating. You know, a woman, you know, even though she becomes a transcendental devotee, Queen Kunti, you know, and you see all the gopis, you know, they're the most transcendental. I mean, you know, who can be more spiritually, you know, they're very, you know, essence, they're very makeup, you know, their bodies are completely spiritual, but, you know, they act like women. They don't, you know, all of a sudden consider, you know, we're advanced devotees, transcendental to the modes of material nature, you know, we'll start acting like men. Any questions on that? Deva Varnashram, of course, means that it's God-centered.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only real difference. Varnashram Dham, without the entire society and each individual effort being dedicated to pleasing the Lord, it's that sort of Varnashram system, which is basically a Suric in one sense.
But it's mentioned that the whole purpose of Varnashram system is to satisfy Vishnu. So
yeah.
By default, Varnashram is Daivi.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. By default, it's Daivi Varnashram.
Yeah.
Previously, one had to take birth in the Brahmana family and also to then be trained as a Brahmana and then to work as a Brahmana, and you know they accepted the thread. It was it's very uncommon, you know, because Varnashram was actually existing, that someone from the Sudra background would want to be trained as a Brahmana or a Kshatriya. But as far as I understand, no, they, in the strict Varnashram system, they weren't, you know, as far as I understand. In our Sampradaya, up until the time of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, we also didn't give Brahman thread. The previous acharyas didn't give Brahman thread to anyone, because unless they were born in a Brahmana family, even though they were trained as Brahmanas and accepted as Brahmanas in our movement, you know, from the times of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It was Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati who introduced that, yes, now they shall have the thread as well. Because the Brahmana community were stubbornly accepting them as something less, and therefore he said you cannot accept as less, because therefore I'll give the Brahman thread so that you show, you know. But before that, in our Sampradaya, we didn't get the thread, although we were trained as Brahmanas and accepted as Brahmanas and worshipped the deities and what have you. So, and that was because that was what was done in Vedic times, even when the Pancharatrika was applied. That's my understanding. So, but still, although he gave the Brahminical thread, he still, you know, it was awarded that the men, you know, wear that, but still, you know, in general, women, although they also take Brahminical training, you know, and become Vaishnavas, it's still understood that they, work in cooperation with their husband, you know, their father, you know, as that principle for a woman is so important that it should not be overrided, you know, even amongst the, you know, even for transcendentalists. Yeah.
So it comes like women leadership, kind of issue. And yes, women can give initiation.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. No. So let's take that as a, you know. So for instance,
And let me just finish, if I may.
Yeah, go on.
The other thing is about, we do not like the austerity. Mm. If women climb into the funeral pyres of their husbands, they could not be made to be through.
Yes.
In Quincy, mm. And 14 years in the forest, and then also went to the forest at Bonaparte time.
Yes. yes, so let's take then one at a time. No, it's good, yeah. On the first one, say for instance we have women take initiation and they have, so for instance we have Narottam Das, of course, daughter, Nalini or something like that. And I think also may have even been his wife as well, except the disciples. You know, there are other examples of you know, women within you know, since the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there was Gangamati Goswami. I think she also accepted disciples. she was a Goswami. See, she was even Goswami, renounced Lord of Life. So not only can they become gurus, they can also accept sannyas. Generally, but it's you know, exceptional. But in those cases, those women who were acting as gurus, still she did not become independent from her husband, or the daughter independent from the father. That principle never changed. But you know, so much independent, you know, completely independent on the transcendental platform, on the material platform. But for say that dependence, you know, is not a, let me say, it's a, let me say, you know, a politeness. It's a, you know, you know. So, for instance, say we take the example where a woman becomes a guru, and her husband's also a guru. Because of that relationship between them, she's not likely to say, now I'm a guru, now I've been waiting for this time, now I'm going to be independent from you. You know what I mean? Because there's still a bond on the transcendental platform, out of humility, in order to set an example for others. Of course, if she's a guru, everyone's going to follow her. And if she decides, you know, I'm totally independent from that man, although he's a, you know, great devotee of the Lord, everyone's going to follow her, and that includes the 99% of people who are not qualified, you know, for you know, proper transcendental realization. That would set a very, very bad precedent. Krishna didn't want that. We see in the Bhagavad Gita that Krishna didn't want Arjuna to give up his profession also, his natural. Because had Arjuna taken up sannyas and renounced his activities as a fighter, and everyone who reads the Bhagavad Gita now would think, in order to become, to show that I'm advanced, I have to give up my duties. So how many women will be abandoned, children? So you get the men, you know, that they've had children, they got married, all of a sudden it's like, boy, a lot of work in this. Bhagavad Gita, all of a sudden I'm advanced devotees, you know, following in the footsteps of Arjuna, I'm giving up this. That's what the world will be doing. So, you know, there are, you see that a transcendentalist, but she may, you know, a woman who's a guru, a very elevated spiritual person, may actually act completely independently, as in the example of Gangamata Goswamini. She took sannyas, no dependence on any man at all. So it's not that they can't, and it's not that they're actually dependent. But, you know, there's a principle which is stated in the Nectar Devotion that an advanced transcendentalist, they can choose to follow regular principles or not follow. It doesn't affect them at all. Most often they choose to follow, one, out of sense of humility, and in Narada Bhakti Sutra, Narada says also out of sense of caution, because how many people get caught out thinking, now I'm so advanced, give up these regular principles, all of a sudden Maya comes in, bang, bang, bang. So out of a sense of caution, out of sense of humility, and out of a sense that others are following, they will. But you're correct in that a woman who's a transcendentalist does not necessarily need to depend on any man. There's no reason for it other than for the benefit of others and out of the, you know, relationship that she may have with that, you know, other transcendentalist who happens to be in a man's body. But they don't need to. But to establish a general principle for the mass of people who are following these things, therefore the Brahman thread is not given, just to establish that principle that, for, you know, generally, I mean, for 99% of people we see even who come to ISKCON, you know, how many actually become very advanced, you know, amongst the thousands that come. And for those majority of people, they should understand that you're better off to follow the natural way of life for a man, for a woman, you know, what have you. Don't give up your natural duties that all of a sudden you've read a couple of verses, turned a couple of rounds, all of a sudden you've given up all these duties which are really protecting your, you know, piety in such a strong way. So, you know, for those reasons there. Mm.
So Varnashram is
a,
like a safety net.
Oh, it is. Yeah. You know, that's Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 18th chapter, that even, you know, for advanced transcendentalists, they should never give up, you know, the duty in the sense of charity, penances, austerity. These things should never be given up. Even if you're advanced, you know, your natural, you know, these are austerities of the body, mind, and what's the third one? And words. These austerities, these duties that we have, that we act in the mode of goodness without attachment, they should never be given up. But sometimes, if for the sake of it is more pleasing to Krishna, because for a higher principle, for everyone's benefit, then a devotee will immediately give up any of these regular principles. They're not dependent upon them. So an advanced person can either follow them or not follow them, and it's actually their choice. An advanced woman in ISKCON, it is her choice that she will either follow certain regular principles like that or not, and it makes no difference to her advancement. But generally, for the sake of the amount of people following, she will follow, and also for the sake of caution and humility, they will follow. Therefore, you know, I know that I was reading Indrajumna Swami. He was had this dream that you know, he travels all over the world and you know, preaching. And Srila Prabhupada appeared to him in a dream and said, "I want you to carry your sannyas danda." I think I was speaking to Bhakti Sarah about that. You know, so he didn't think much of it, and then he had another dream. Prabhupada appears and said, "I want you to carry your sannyas danda. I've told you, you know, you haven't done it." So he thought, oh, so he got one that, oh, it was a mini. a little mini danda. I said, well, you know, not really a danda. And one that he could pack in a case. Prabhupada appeared again. I want you to carry your danda. You know, so he got his danda, and he got one that, long one, proper side, but could fold. So he takes that. So it appears, you know, it's a regulative principle for sannyas. Now, of course, those who are paramahamsas, which is the top level of sannyas, they don't need to carry a danda. Nor do they need to wear the sannyas attire as a paramahamsa. There's a top level of the four levels of sannyas. Śrīla Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati accepted the sannyas and not Babaji. And he carried a danda. And he accepted that because he knew that had he accepted, although he was qualified, the Babaji Vesa, the dress of a Babaji, topmost, Paramahamsa, everyone would follow him. And there, and he wanted to show that the disciple should always, out of humility, be below his guru. Never equal, never above. And so he accepted sannyas. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also accepted sannyas. So it's not just that women have to follow particular etiquettes like that. Even as sannyasi is following the very same principle as a woman, you know, even though they're very advanced transcendental, it's the same principle throughout the board. So it's not that because you're a woman you have to follow this, men don't have to follow any. It's the same, exact same principle. Yeah. So therefore, you know, although it's a small thing, you carry a danda, what's the big thing? The big thing is that it should be seen that even our sannyasis always set the example for others. Don't give up these rules and regulations too quickly. Don't think that you're advanced too quickly. And don't think that all of a sudden you become as, you know, good as your guru. You know, always keep. So this is the mood of Kunti, and this is what we're learning from this verse.
Can I ask you something related, as you raised directly related? If conduct permits disciples to become sannyasis while the great spiritual masters are alive, what's the logic there?
Who is his spiritual master?
Jayadvaita Swami.
yes, again, we see that Shyamananda Prabhu, his disciple was Rasikananda, and he asked Rasikananda Prabhu also to initiate, even while Shyamananda was actively, you know, initiating as a guru. So it's not that it can't be done. Our acharyas have done that. As a general principle, as a general etiquette, it's followed for the same reason that one always keeps oneself in a humble situation. You're a guru, I'm disciple, you know. And never shall I even entertain the thought that I'm somehow equal or just as good, what to speak of above. Therefore, Rasikananda, although he was initiating guru, and so was Shyamananda Prabhu, whenever his spiritual master would present, he would not speak. And if his spiritual master would ask him, I want you to, you know, preach on this point, I want to hear you speak on this verse. And he would speak in a very low voice, very soft, you know, very, very timidly, just for a few minutes and then stop. And when his spiritual master was not present, he would, you know, roar and, you know, hours, 20, like this. So, you know, that principle of humility is, you know, what we're learning here from, is a very good quality. So it's not that just because she's a woman she's accepting this, but it's actually on any level of devotee, it's the same principle that should be there. So in other words, again, if a man reads this and thinking, oh, you know, women should always think like that, but, you know, the men will read this verse and think, well, that's for women. They should think like that. But they're not understanding. If you're a guru, if you're a sannyas, if you're anything, if you're a Vaishnava of any caliber, you'll be thinking like this. Because, you know, Queen Kundi is such an exalted devotee of the Lord that she's, you know, associate, you know, Lord Sri Krishna. And, you know, she's intensely attached to the Lord, you know, in pure love. So in order to get to that position, we have to, every devotee, no one should ever think I'm so advanced that, you know, that this verse here of Queen Kunti, you know, does not apply to me.
Is she
Queen Kunti? As far as I understand, these are, you know, eternally liberated. They're certainly, whether they've, they're certainly nitya siddha at this point. In other words, you know, whether someone has come to associate with Krishna in such a role in his pastime. Some of them did, and they were not necessarily nitya siddha, you know, at that point. But at this last stage of intense association, they become nitya siddha. So, but I'm not exactly sure, you know, with Queen Kunti what her position was. But, can I just? I'm just going to have a break for a second, go to the bathroom, and I'll come back. I don't want anyone to leave. I want to discuss the children, as you can hear, downstairs where we would usually be. I spoke to Chantabal and I left them in there to give me more time to do your essays without too much home study at home. What's that? Hello. Yes. In what way you mean? Okay. Yeah. Yes. You know. Also, in teachings of Queen Kunti, and you find also like Nectar of Devotion. You know, this verse is quite often quoted by different acharyas and in different shastras that we study, and it is, you know, because there's a lot in it. Sometimes the verse is spoken in such a way as it emphasizes mental speculators, and at other times it emphasizes actually qualified transcendentalists more so than speculators who are qualified to hear the science of devotion. And and then Queen Kunti's statement, how then can we women know you perfectly? As we see, you know, it's a very simple statement in one sense, question, but it can be worded in different ways to really bring out a lot of different feelings, you know, aspects to what she's thinking. So, all right, looking for who's got the notes of lesson notes. Lesson again. We've got, this is lesson two, and we should be up to text 24 of the 8th chapter. We've covered most of it except, you know, from verses 18 to 24, we've only really looked at one of Queen Kunti's prayers. The others we can go over certainly a lot quicker than what we did today. So that won't take us a lot. The next lesson three, it is specific texts 26 and 30. Well, you know, we can look at 26 to 31. Actually, really from 24 to 45 is what's included in lesson three, but the main things that it's our discussion will centre on is 26 to 31. But you probably, if you get the chance, you can read up to text 45. So we should, by next week, you know, really understanding text 18 to 45, which is with a special emphasis on what we could have covered today, 18 to 24, and then 26 to 31. One of the other things that we perhaps can look at is verses 11 and 17 of chapter 9. What's that? 11 to 17. So, you know, see here. I don't think we're finished in 2 years, but one thing that we are doing, when I first worked out the schedule, I was looking at, you know, an average pace of about two lessons for our double lesson session, right? We're not doing that, but I included less classes in that schedule. So when I worked out that schedule, there were a lot of breaks. The year started late, ended early, with a lot of breaks. We've mostly kept going, you know, week after week, without too many interruptions, and that's allowed us to actually go a little slower, and yet, you know, so it'll take us a little longer, but not exceptionally longer, because we're getting more classes in than what I originally anticipated. So if we can sort of do that, we can sort of go along at a slightly slower pace, and if we just keep the regular classes without too many breaks, then we'll keep up a good pace as well.
Will we break at the end of the year?
Yeah, we'll break at the end of the year, and that's what we've got to look at is, you know, when we get you know, a little closer to the end, we'll have a discussion on you know, how we're going to break and what have you, keeping in mind that, you know, it doesn't bother me too much, but, you know, to you know, I think to keep the whole Bhakti Bhai Bhava, you know, within a good time of a few years rather than 10, you know, something which it can easily get to. And one of the ways that we'll do that is just to keep up regular classes without too many breaks. That allows us to go at a slow pace and yet, you know, finish it nicely. Alright. Most likely next week we'll be just looking at the prayers of Queen Kunti, up to text 45. If you've got extra time, have a look at those verses, you know, of Bhishma, 11 to 17 in chapter 9. But it's not likely that we'll get there, but it doesn't hurt, because by the time we get there, if you're very familiar with it, it's good. And of course, I'll get the rest of the essays pretty much up next week. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? No. You're whispering out. Oh, thank you very much.